This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Fans of NBC's The Office and HBO's The Wire have something to look forward to. Starting a week from tonight, Idris Elba, who played Stringer Bell on The Wire, will have a recurring role on The Office as Michael Scott's new boss. As Stringer, Elba played the co-leader of a drug organization that controlled a lot of corners on West Baltimore streets. He was all about business. If you opposed him or betrayed him, you were dead. And he was smart. He studied business and was trying to go legit, or semi-legit, in the real estate business. Elba will be intimidating again, in a more corporate way, in his new role on The Office. Here's a preview of next week's episode called The New Boss. In this scene, he's being introduced to the staff by Michael Scott, head of the Scranton branch of the Dunder Mifflin Paper Company. Michael is played by Steve Carell.
Everyone, please give it up for Charles Minor.
Thank you, Michael. And thank you for the C-shaped bagels.
Oh, well.
Great. That's great.
Above and beyond.
Hey, you know, we're in tough times and we're not immune to this economy.
That's true.
But the goal is to, you know, fight our way through this. Hey.
Stanley Hudson. Are there going to be layoffs?
No, absolutely not.
Hold on, Michael. Thank you. Stanley, you know, we can't make any promises, but we'll try everything in our power to avoid that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have specifics?
Michael should have filled you in last week.
Well, due to the economy, there's a lot of worry going around. I didn't want to worry
you didn't tell
people.
Them.
Well,
no.
Why don't?
Yeah, what I told Michael
Charles is going to tell you
is that we are cutting 3% across the board, which means we will no longer be matching 401k contributions, and all overtime requests will need to come through the corporate office.
Fantastic.
Well, it's not official.
It is official.
Well,
it is official. Maybe. And actually, guys, I'm encouraging branches to consider a freeze on discretionary spending.
Such as salary, benefits, et cetera, et cetera, insurance.
Not salaries. Petty cash,
right.
Supplies, and, you know, parties, things like that.
Well.
What about your party?
No, well, then. Okay. You know what? I think this has been great. I think this gives us a lot to think about, doesn't it? Charles Minor, ladies and gentlemen, he has a long trip home.
Steve Carell and my guest Idris Elba in a scene from next week's episode of The Office. Elba's films include American Gangster, Tyler Perry's Daddy's Little Girl, Rock and Rolla, 28 Weeks Later, and Obsessed, which comes out next month. Idris Elba, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm a big fan. It's a pleasure to have you here. Since The Office with you on it hasn't started yet, why don't you describe your role?
Well, I play a character called Charles Minor, and Charles is he's been brought in from the head office of Dunder Mifflin to come to Scranton and basically clean up shop. You know, he's kind of Michael Scott's superior, and, you know, he's very rigid. He's a very rigid guy, doesn't have much of a sense of humor with his employees, and he basically comes in and takes over. The character was written, I guess they wanted to have me sort of play a sort of corporate version of Stringer Bell, if you like. but what's, I'm having a lot of fun working with the character, and he has quirks, you know. He's a corporate guy, yes he is, but he puts on a show. Everything he's learned from sort of self-help books and stuff, and, you know, he's in business manuals. And then when we do the sort of on camera, what they call a talking head, you know, you start to reveal who his real personality is. I'm having so much fun. I never get to do comedy, so Charles.
That's
Minor
what I
is
thought.
My,
yeah,
my comic relief.
Well, let me just interrupt here and say the people who know you as Stringer Bell on The Wire are going to be so disoriented hearing your voice because, you know, you're British, but to hear the person who many of us know as Stringer Bell with a British accent, I just wanted to acknowledge how disorienting that's going to be for a lot of people. So are you British or American in The Office?
I'm American in The Office. And you know, it's funny, they called and said, we'd like to do the show. And I was like, yes, can I play English? And they were like, yes, play English. And then like 2 days before we started filming, they're like, you know what? We don't think the audience is going to get the English thing. Let's go American. Which was disappointing. You know, I really was looking forward to sort of working on my own accent and, you know, but.
What a cruel irony, because The Office started as a British show, but you have to play American. So are you doing the same American accent that you did on The Wire, or is it a different American accent?
Oh, it's different. Yeah, it's different. This guy's from, where was he born? He's from D.C., but he's sort of, you know, very corporate. And so it's not, you know, he's not like Stringer, who was sort of street corporate. This guy's very clipped. Speaks quite well.
Now, how did you get the part on The Office? Were the people on The Office a big fan of you as Stringer Bell on The Wire?
Yeah, believe it or not, huge fans of The Wire. And I think what really got them was Rock and Roller, I think.
This is a movie.
The movie Rock and Roller with Guy Ritchie. And, you know, there was a comedic twist to my character, if you like, and I think that made them think, maybe he can do some comedy. So I got the call. But they're huge fans of The Wire. Like, every day it's like, oh my God, it's Stringer Bell on our set. I'm like,
are there any Stringer Bell in jokes?
No. Don't kill me. That one's good. What are you going to do, have me whacked? You know, that they say stuff like that, but...
So in The Office, is there much improv within it?
Yes, there is. The great thing about The Office is that they allow you to explore with your character. So what they'll do is they'll give you your scripted version, and then they'll say, okay, so why don't we do one where you just have fun with it? They apply that in the talking head sections a lot. So a lot of Steve, you know, Steve is an improv king. Steve Carell. Yeah, Steve Carell is an improv king. So he'll get on and do his talking head as scripted, and then he'll just do his version. And they allow everyone to sort of do that. It's a lot of fun. I'm having a phenomenal time working on it. I love it.
Is there a scene that you remember improvising within it?
Yeah, Steve and I did this one scene where basically he loses it for a second and starts to repeat everything I say just to try and embarrass my character in front of the rest of the team. And so, you know, I say, what? He says, what? I said, how old are you? Yeah, how old are you? And, you know, and then that scene we ended up improvising. So my character was like, oh, really? You want to improvise me? Okay, repeat after me. I want to get fired. I don't want to get fired. It was so funny. We were just going back and forth. And then I ended up doing like, I was doing the some body popping, and he started body popping too, and it just went wild.
My guest is Idris Elba, and he's best known for his part as Stringer Bell on The Wire, and he's about to join the cast of The Office for 6 episodes, playing Michael's new boss. Is that the fair way of putting it? New boss?
Yeah, okay. The new boss. Yeah, you're right on it.
Now, you are best known for your role as Stringer Bell, and I want to play a scene from The Wire, so let me kind of set up the whole thing. So as Stringer Bell, you ran a drug operation with your partner, Avon Barksdale, and you guys buy the drugs and have kids on the corner selling them. And your character, Stringer, is more ambitious than his partner, Avon. Stringer's been investing his money in real estate, and in season 3, he's organized an agreement between the major drug dealers in the Baltimore that they would jointly buy drugs from New York at this kind of group discount price instead of going to war with each other. Mm-hmm. And Stringer's partner...
Ingenious. Isn't that ingenious?
And Stringer's partner, Avon, who's just gotten out of prison, he wants things the way they used to be on the street, the kind of street thing he's familiar with. And he wants his corners back, the ones that were taken by this newcomer named Marlowe while Avon was in prison. And you're trying to convince your partner, Avon, not to worry about the corners because this cooperative deal is going to be very profitable. So before we actually play this clip, I should mention again, this is a scene from The Wire. There's a lot of, you know, explicit language in it. So here's the scene.
Thing about turf, man, it ain't like it was. I mean, you ain't got to pay no price of buying no corners. Since when do we buy corners? We take corners.
Man, you gonna buy one way or another.
Whether it's with the bodies we don't lost,
or you're gonna lose. Time in the joint is behind us or ahead of us. I mean, you gonna get some in this game, but ain't shit for free. Uh-uh. I mean, how many corners do we need? How much money can a nigga make?
More than a nigga can spend.
And then we ain't gonna be around to spend what we done made already.
I didn't think I was gonna be around this long.
Yeah. Well, we here now. The fact is, we got every mob in town, east side, west side, ready to pull together. Share territory on that good shit that Pop Joe putting out there. We take that shit downtown and we get in a money game that niggas ain't going to jail. I mean, we passed that running gun shit, man. Like, we finance a package and we ain't got to see nothing but bank. Nothing but cash. No corners, no territory, nothing. We make so much goddamn straight money, man. Government come after us, man. Ain't shit they could say.
Businessmen, huh?
Let the youngins worry about how to retail, where the wholesale. I mean, who gives a f- who's standing on what corner if we taking that shit off the top, putting that shit to good use, making that shit work for us? We can run more than corners, B. Period. We could do like Little Willie, man, back in the day with all that number money and run this goddamn city.
The scene from The Wire, my guest Idris Elba played Stringer Bell. So Idris Elba, how did you get the part of Stringer Bell? And was it hard for you to get it as somebody who's British and had to convince them that you could convincingly do American Street?
At the time, you know, it was sort of like 3 years here in the States and I was auditioning all the time for work and couldn't get a job. I mean, I couldn't catch a cold. I think I did Law and Order. It's like a bit part in Law and Order. But I was auditioning all the time for great, great parts, but they weren't coming my way. Alexa Fogel, who is the casting director of The Wire, told me to come in. I was casting a film called Brown Sugar. And she said to me, you know, thank you for coming back and back into all the callbacks. I have this other show I'm working on that I'd like you to audition for. It's a small part, but if you're interested, it's for HBO. So she said, just come in, read for us, and do me a favor, come in with your American accent. Cool. So I walked in. I see David Simon, Ed Burns, and I auditioned for Avon Barksdale. Okay, so 5 auditions later, they say, we don't want you for Avon. We think you'd be better playing Stringer. And like at that point, you know, so I knew the script. It was the pilot edition. I knew the script inside out. And they said, you know, what do you think about Stringer? And like, I was like, Stringer? Like, yeah, it's like 2 lines. Yeah, I'll take it. Because I was desperate to work. They didn't know at the time that I was English because I didn't, you know, Alexa Fogel did, but Ed Burns and David Simon didn't know. I kept that away from them because I really wanted to bag this job. When they gave it to me, I then said, you know, hey guys, you know, I appreciate it. And they were like, wait a second, where are you from? And then Alexa and I just let it out. And they were like, whoa. So that was how I got that job.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Idris Elba. He played Stringer Bell on The Wire, and he's about to co-star in 6 episodes of The Office as Michael's new boss. What did you think of your character, Stringer Bell? On the one hand, he's really smart. You know, he comes up through the streets, but he's educated himself. He has a lot of business smarts, even though he's ultimately outsmarted by politicians who are more corrupt, or at least as corrupt as he is. But he's really smart. He invests in things. He's ambitious. At the same time, he's cold. He's ruthless. He kills without thinking twice about it. He betrays people without thinking twice about it. So what did you think of this character?
I mean, once I started to get to know who Stringer was, he very much reminded me of some of the people I grew up with in London. I mean, in England, you know, they would put you in jail for a bag of weed. So, you know, selling drugs was like covert operation. Like, you know, you just weren't riding around and flash cars and, you know what I'm saying, standing on corners and stuff like that. It may be that way now, but it certainly wasn't that way when I was growing up. Drug dealers were very, very, were gentlemen. They had offices. You know, they had a very, very, you know, strict way of doing what they did. So it reminded me of these drug dealers that I knew in England that just had to be real smart about their business. They just had to be very, they had to have a front. So they wear the suit, they have the operation, the shop, they put their money into laundromats or whatever, and just have an operation that makes them look legit. Stringer reminds me of that. I think that Stringer wanted to be, you know, a businessman and exceed in business. That's why he went to business school. I think the drug thing definitely was a temporary stop for him. I think he wanted to move forward.
The N-word is used a lot in The Wire, and it's such a big issue in the United States, like if who has the right to use the word and if anybody should use it, and if it's different in hip-hop than it is in another context, if a white person can say it, if a black person can say it, you know the whole drill on that.
Yeah.
Is it an issue in England? Is it a word that's much used in England?
No. I mean, it was a fad for a while. It was like, you know, everybody was saying it because it was on the records. It was part of hip-hop. You know,
right,
it was being
right.
said. But no, nobody should use that word. And, you know, I've used it and, you know, kind of always, you know, just kind of grimaced to myself, like, why are you saying that? It's just not even, it doesn't make any sense. In England, you know, the word isn't used like that. And actually, you know, it's like it's very, you can't, if you say it, like people stop in a room. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's a bigger deal in England to say it.
Hmm.
It's considered very racist to say that.
Now, your character, Stringer Bell, was killed in the next to the last episode of season 3. Did you know that was coming? Like, when did you find out that Stringer Bell was going to get shot?
I knew that he was going to get shot maybe 2 or 3 episodes before it happened.
Was it upsetting?
Yeah. I wasn't going to get that check anymore.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like the writers killed you?
No, I think the show made me as an artist for sure, and established me here in the States. As far as Stringer was concerned, like it was inevitable that that character was going to die, so it was inevitable. I think that you know, to be true, honest with you, I was celebrated the idea that Stringer was going to get shot because I didn't want him to go out on a sort of on a bed of glory. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is a guy that sells drugs to communities, to kids, and gets kids to sell drugs for him. And he was celebrated, loved, adored. And for me and the writers, it was, you know, killing Stringer was, you know, let's put a middle finger up to that ideology. You know what I'm saying? Like, drug dealers are not cool, period. So I celebrated the idea. Of course, I love Stringer Bell. And I love the fact that this was a character of huge complexities, you know what I mean? But I felt that it was right for him to die. I felt it was right for him to die at the pinnacle of his fame, if you like, you know what I mean? I think that it was almost Shakespearean, the way that the writers put that together, because you just did not see that coming, you know what I mean?
So you like the death scene they wrote for you?
Well, no, I thought the death scene was actually, and this was between you and I and whoever's listening, rushed. I thought the death scene was rushed. I didn't understand how Brother Muzone and Omar conspired so quickly to kill Stringer. Like, to me, if you consider the history of how slowly The Wire, you know, unravels stories, that particular storyline came too quickly, too fast, and it certainly felt like a rush job. But it remains in history one of the best death scenes you've ever seen.
We're getting it from two people.
Yeah, exactly.
And what are your final words before you get shot?
I think the final words were, well, get on with it, mother.
That's right. And then you get shot before you can finish the expletive.
All right. He goes that out right. With some gutso.
That is right. Do you have a favorite scene from The Wire that you're in?
No. Okay. Honestly, I didn't see much of what we did.
No.
No, I didn't see. I didn't see any of... I saw some of season one. I didn't see any of season two. And I saw the last scene with Wood and I when I tell him that I killed D'Angelo. I saw that scene. I don't typically like to watch my work.
Well, so you didn't see much of The Wire. You don't even know why we like it so much.
I do know why, because it's phenomenal. But I'm not a fan of watching my own work, and I don't watch TV too much either. Mm.
Now, another thing you're known for is on Jay-Z's famous album, American Gangster, you do the introduction. Mm-hmm. And before we talk about it, let's hear it.
A gangster is not defined by how low your jeans fall by your waist, but more how your genes stand over his expectations.
Never forgetting where we came.
Your gangster.
Your gangster is not defined by how many rocks are in your watch, but more how many rocks you move while on your watch.
Gangsters, hustlers, Republicans and Democrats, pimps and hoes.
Conservatives, labor, the seller, the buyer, the product, the producer.
So you are what you are.
A gangster is absorbed and adored by those that don't understand the laws that govern gangstermen.
Gangstermen.
My guest, Idris Elba, doing the introduction to Jay-Z's album, American Gangster. Now, because you were so admired in The Wire as a gangster, and because you were in the movie American Gangster, and because you're on Jay-Z's American Gangster, do a lot of your fans assume you're really into being a gangster? And do people sometimes have, like, false expectations of you?
I mean, clearly, you know, people... first of all, people were very shocked by the fact that I'm not from America. Okay, that's number one. But it's no new news now. People know. I remember when I was, you know, sort of second season of The Wire, and it was just, you know, everyone was going crazy for this show. And, you know, people, gangsters would come up to me all the time, like, yo, my man, yo, my man, yo, you playing my life right now. And, I'd be like, oh, thanks very much, mate. Thanks very much. Appreciate that. We're looking at me like, yo, who the hell are you? You know what I mean? So, yes, there is definitely, you know, people think that I'm sort of partly like Stringer. And in many ways I am, but I'm not a gangster. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, I guess people presume that I'm a gangster. I have a lot of friends in the industry, in the hip hop industry, a lot of friends, and they personify that sort of whole world. I guess people think I'm part of that, but at the same time, I'm very vocal about Stringer dying. I've been vocal about that. You know, I'm not. You know, I don't celebrate the fact that he was the greatest gangster you've seen on TV since Tony Soprano. I don't know.
Now, you have a music life as well as an acting life. Let's talk about your music. Let's start at the beginning. You started DJing, I think, with your uncle in your early teens in England. So what kind of DJing did he do when you started working with him?
Well, my parents are from West Africa, Sierra Leone, and my uncle was the go-to DJ. When everyone was getting, you know, if he was having a christening, a Sierra Leonean christening or a Sierra Leonean wedding, my uncle was that guy. You go to him, he had all the records. He had a sound system called Sound International. So Sound International would travel all over England and play for these parties. And as soon as I was, like, allowed to, you know, leave my home, my parents allowed me to go with my uncle and DJ. He has three sons as well, so we would all go with him and DJ. And basically what would happen is my uncle's a little bit of a player, okay? Get to these parties, get the party cracking, and then slope off with some young bridesmaid or something and leave the and then leave the turntables unattended with me and my little younger cousins looking at these things like, what do we do next? So eventually, of course, we started to DJ and take over. And that's where it came from. I have this picture. I wish I could show you this picture. I was like 4 years old, and I'm wearing these dungarees. I've got this white T-shirt. I've got these African beads around my neck. And I have in my hand Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On, the album. And I'm literally staring at the turntable like, let me at it. It's a great picture. My dad has it. I'm going to use it.
What were the records that meant the most to you when you were young?
Wow. A lot of African music, because my dad is huge on African, especially Congolese music from the Congo, which is melodic, it's bossa nova sounding, lots of guitars. So some of those records, for which I don't even know what they're saying because they're speaking in French, but these records mean a lot to me. I grew up, you know, in the vinyl era, so I remember seeing, Stevie Wonder's Master Blaster on 12-inch and like, oh my God, playing that record as loud as you could and just dancing forever. I remember there was a record called Disco. It was like D-I-S-C-O. It's an old school record, and it was one of the first records I bought. It was like 7-inch. And I remember, you know, you had to put the little round thing in the middle of the record before you could play it because it had a hole in it. You know, these are records that I grew up with as a kid. I mean, my house, my dad would have the music and the TV all on at the same time. I mean, all day. I remember doing my homework to the sound of thumping bass underneath us. Like my bedroom would be above the living room, and I'd be doing my homework. That was my soundtrack. It was like listening to my dad's music.
Well, I think it's time to hear you sing. So let's play some of your music. And this isn't a final mix, so it's not like it's out yet. It's not. But you've kindly allowed us to play some of it anyways. So we're going to hear The Best I Can. And I should say you're recording this under the name Driss, as in Idris, but spelled D-R-I-I-S, adding that extra I in the middle.
Very clever. little letter play right there.
And do you want to say anything to introduce us?
Yeah, Best I Can. Like, you know, I've been doing music for a long time in my bedroom. Always had equipment and stuff. And, you know, I just figured out that I want to put some music out there. I'm not a singer, but I can sing. I can hold a note, I guess. And I just wanted to put some songs out. Best I Can is a part of a collection of records that I'm going to put out maybe at the end of this year. And you know, it's kind of like hybrid of all the music I like. I love all kinds of music. So Best I Can is kind of like an R&B soulful joint, but there's elements of reggae in it. So take a listen, tell me what you think.
So here's The Best I Can, sung by my guest, Idris Elba, recording under the name Driss. And again, this isn't available yet. This is just a sneak peek preview.
The best that I can. Here I go. Here I stand. Doing the best I can. Doing the best I can.
My guest Idris Elba singing. He's best known for his role as Stringer Bell on The Wire, and he's about to join the cast of The Office for 6 episodes where he'll play Michael's new boss. Well, I think that sounds pretty good. Now,
thank you.
You were telling me before we started recording the interview that you've been taking singing lessons.
Yeah, I just wanted to learn how to use my voice a little bit. As an actor, you know, you use your voice and you use your diaphragm and all of that stuff. But in terms of in the studio and singing songs, that's a completely different animal. So I'm working with a guy called Roger, who's phenomenal, and he's helping me, you know, develop my sound. You know, my music, I guess my voice is influenced by reggae, just reggae songs. Like, I grew up around a lot of reggae. And, you know, Gregory Isaacs, for example, like his voice is just so textured and he sings these great love songs.
Can you tell me something you've learned about your voice from singing lessons?
Wow. it's powerful. My voice is very powerful. I didn't know that I can sing pretty loud, and I didn't know that. I did, back in the day, I did a show called Guys and Dolls. I played Big Julie. Big
oh, no.
Big Julie.
So you got
Chicago.
To sing, I've Got the Horse Right Here.
I Got the Horse, right, exactly. And that was the first time I ever sung. And I remember the, you know, it was part of the National Theatre's youth program. And they took, you know, very talented kids, put them in professional shows and took them all around the world. And I was cast in this show. And that was the first time I sung. And they told me, you've got a great singing voice for musicals. And I was like, yeah. And I never did it. And here I am, singing again.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Mm. My guest is Idris Elba, and he starred on The Wire as Stringer Bell, who was a drug dealer. And now he's starting on The Office for 6 episodes, playing Michael's new boss. Can you tell us about the neighborhood you grew up in England?
Yeah, I'm an East Londoner. And actually, I was born within 3 mile radius of the Bow Bells. If you're born within 3 mile radius of the Bow Bells, you are what is known as a Cockney. So I am literally a Cockney. I was born in Forestgate and moved to Hackney as a young kid. Hackney is very much like Queens, if you like.
Like Queens, New York?
Queens, New York. Where Brixton is more like Brooklyn, Hackney is more like Queens, where it's working class neighborhood, mixed, decent schools. My parents loved Hackney. And then when I was around 9, 10, they decided to move to another area called Canning Town, which is further east. And at the time was 90% white. And they didn't like black people. Truth of the matter. I remember arriving at school, I think on my first week, being chased home by a bunch of white kids calling me all kinds of stuff. And I remember thinking, what? I came from Hackney, where that is just like unheard of. I get to Canning Town and I'm dealing with this. It was like traumatic.
So when you moved to the United States, was the experience of being black here, both as an actor and just as a person, much different than your range of experiences in England?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, African-American culture was, I wasn't sort of alien to it because it came to England as part of hip-hop and music and R&B and the videos and the Fresh Prince and the Cosby Show. So, you know what I mean? I was very much aware of what was happening in America. But, you know, England is primarily Afro-Caribbeans. So Jamaicans, West Indians, and Africans. Okay, that's the black culture. And I get to America, and there's African-Americans all of a sudden, and it's completely different. You know, I remember thinking when I got to America, I was like, I'd ask someone, so where are you from? They'd be like, Brooklyn. Yeah, but where are you really from? Brooklyn. Oh, you mean my parents? Pennsylvania? I'd be like, wow, hold on a second. Like, I couldn't understand that. You know, you don't have no roots to Africa or the West Indies? That was a shock for me. Didn't get that at first. But I celebrated the African-American culture because I think it's one of the most successful cultures in the world, considering what our culture's been through. And I think that was a huge part of my draw here. I felt that in England, sort of like a glass ceiling to what you could do there, culturally within ourselves. You know, my parents would be like, why do you want to be an actor? Actors don't make money. You want to work in Fords with me? No, that was considered a good job, stable job.
Work in the Ford factory.
Yeah. You go to America, and African Americans are running businesses. And so I came here to pursue acting. Because the characters that I'm seeing in films, I mean, you've got movie stars, black movie stars. There's no black movie stars in England. There weren't at the time. I remember one of my first auditions as an actor. I was in the room with an actor I'd been watching for 10 years. He was 20 years older than me, and he and I was up for the same part. I was like, huh? How? What? He looked young, and he looked great, but he and I were up for the same part. And I was like, this cannot be. Like, what, how am I going to survive as an actor out here? My ambition is way too big for the room. So America was where I ended up.
You said there were no black movie stars in England, and there certainly are in the United States. And, of course, you played with one of them, Denzel Washington, in American Gangster. And I read a quote from you where you said, Denzel never shows up on the set. It's his character who comes to work. And I'm wondering what that was like for you, if you'd worked with actors like that before who stay in character on the set, and if that's disorienting for you as an actor who isn't that way?
No. I mean, growing up as an actor when I was about 18, 19, I was fascinated with Robert De Niro. Like, Robert De Niro was my idol and a huge method actor. So, you know, I was very aware of the method and wanted to practice it for myself. But, you know, it's kind of not the kind of practice you can do for every role, okay? I'm sure Denzel doesn't use the method for all his roles. I think in the case of Frank Lucas, an American Gangster, which is an intense role, and he was in New York, I think that worked for him to stay in character. It's not disorienting for me at all. I sometimes stay in character when I'm working, especially, you know, like, for example, in The Office right now, I'm playing Charles Minor. It's very tough, excuse me, to have personal conversations as Idris while I'm playing Charles. So I rather not have conversations, or I'll speak in an American accent the whole time, and which makes me feel like a fake, of course, because people are saying, so where are you from? I'm like, London. No, really, where are you from? Yeah, London, East London. And they were like, okay, it makes me feel like a fake, but, you know, so I guess that's kind of a method, you know, staying in character. But I'm doing that because my accent, I don't want my accent to slip.
So just one more thing. Do you spend a lot of time eavesdropping on conversations on the streets and in restaurants just to hear different versions of American accents?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have a mental Rolodex of so much stuff. Like, I'll, you know, buy a newspaper from the newsstand, and if the guy says something that, I'll ask him, where are you from, bro? Like, I just have, I've done it forever. Even before I was an actor, I just love to listen to the way people speak. When I was in New York auditioning, I would walk around with an American accent all day and see if I could fool people, like the bus driver.
How would you know if you were fooling him or not? I mean,
because if he said, what'd you say, where are you from, and it wasn't working. But if he was like, all right, bro, then I knew, yeah, he thinks I'm from Brooklyn.
So you hardly watch The Wire because you don't like watching yourself. You're going to watch The Office. It's just half-hour episodes. It's easy to take, even if it's you watching yourself.
I you know what? I'll buy the DVD.
Okay.
I won't watch it while it's on. It's too much pressure. I don't read reviews. I don't, you know, I probably won't listen to this radio interview. I just, you know, it's, I love sharing, but at the same time, I don't like watching myself sharing.
Okay. Idris Elba, thanks so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's been great. Thank you.
Idris Elba will co-star in NBC's The Office for 6 episodes starting next Thursday, playing Michael Scott's boss. Elba played Stringer Bell in the HBO series The Wire. His new movie, Obsessed, opens next month. He just completed work on the movie Bone Deep, which is scheduled to open next year. Elba is featured in the first episode of the series The Number One Ladies Detective Agency, which premieres on HBO March 29th. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Beware, the new album by Bonnie Prince Billy. That's the alter ego of Will Oldham, a prolific singer-songwriter who has released scores of albums, singles, and collaborations with other musicians. Ken says this Bonnie Prince Billy project is filled with exciting, if often deceptively laid-back, country rock music.
That's the thing about trouble. You can learn.
That lovely melody with its plaintive Bonnie Prince Billy vocal, keening pedal steel guitar, and loping tempo is typical of the songcraft Will Oldham offers on this superb new album, Beware. The first time you hear that song called You Can't Hurt Me Now, it's easy to get carried along by its sweeping beauty and miss the fact that its lyric is all about isolation and loneliness. The more I feel myself, the more alone I am, sings Bonnie Prince Will Oldham, and you feel for his desolation. It only gets prettier and more despairing.
I want to be your only friend.
It's not scary.
My active mind. Don't wish it so. Watch out for these silent thoughts. That's where the seed of soul sucking grows.
That song, Beware Your Only Friend, is a fine jangle of country rock complete with violin veering into fiddle. It's about friendship turned into, as the narrator puts it, soul-sucking. While Oldham's collaborators chime in with companionable harmony vocals, his words are at odds with such harmony, speaking of the ways in which people who like each other inevitably disappoint and fail each other.
I wanted a woman who loves who I am and what I do. Then I met you. You couldn't care less if I were Lord of Japan or half a man or what I am. You say you like my eyes only or just the way I giggle. Sometimes you like the smell of me or how my stomach jiggles.
In the past, Will Oldham has released music with distorted chords and jagged variations on old gospel and blues music. But in a recent interview in The New Yorker, Will Oldham described his Bonnie Prince Billy persona as, quote, a Brill Building or Nashville songwriter who sings songs with verses, choruses, and bridges. In other words, Oldham sees Prince Billy as expressing his most commercial side, but commercial on his own stubborn terms, which have a distinctly lonesome cowboy pokiness. It's a pokiness I really enjoy, to be sure, but it's also not the kind of Nashville songwriting that shows up in the current music of hitmakers like Sugarland or Taylor Swift. It's more like Willie Nelson meets Graham Parsons' version of the Byrds. Bonnie Prince Billy is a sweetheart of the rodeo.
I don't belong to anyone. There's no one who'll take care of me. It's kind of easy to have some fun when you don't belong to anyone. Time has come to lay childish things to the dirt, see what age brings. If I follow the song I hear, will another come near? For a moment I thought I had.
Will Oldham has another alter ego besides Bonnie Prince Billy. He's done quite a bit of acting in movies such as Junebug, Old Joy, and the recent Michelle Williams movie Wendy and Lucy. In almost everything he does, Oldham radiates a kind of resignation that can either be genial or despairing. He seems consumed by his own thoughts, whether on screen or in a piece of music, but there's one crucial key to the success of Oldham's art. He never comes off self-absorbed. When he titled this album Beware, it may have been a signal that we should come prepared not merely to hear his thoughts, but to hear ourselves and some of our common fears and insecurities in this lovely, passionate music.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Beware, the new CD by Bonnie Prince Billy. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.